At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So, listen, I don't know how to break this to you, but that whole financial crisis, economic Armageddon thing from 4 years ago, yeah, the Justice Department says it's officially nobody's fault. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Friday, the 10th of August. Good to have you with us. All right, so the Justice Department didn't actually say the financial crisis was nobody's fault, but that's what you get if you read between the lines of an announcement the Feds made last night. The government's not going to prosecute Goldman Sachs in the last big case left over from the crisis, a subprime mortgage deal in which the investment bank didn't quite tell investors the whole truth. Goldman did pay a $550 million fine to settle civil charges over the deal, Abacus, it's called, but the DOJ says it can't prove criminal intent, which leaves consumers 4 years on wondering who, if anybody, ought to get the blame. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore starts us off.
If the financial crisis were being hashed out on TV, a lot of people would be in jail right now.
By the time I'm done, you'll be finished.
Frank Partnoy wishes it could be that easy. He's a University of San Diego law professor who used to sell complex financial products on Wall Street.
Unfortunately, life is not like Law and Order. We apply very different standards to Main Street and Wall Street. It's relatively straightforward to go after street crime, but it's awfully, awfully hard to go after Wall Street.
Some recent cases prove that. The Justice Department just dropped its potentially landmark investigation against Goldman Sachs. Last month, a Citigroup manager was acquitted of fraud involving mortgage securities. But that jury encouraged the government to keep hunting for financial crimes.
I think that it's unlikely that we're going to see any meaningful cases arising out of the financial crisis. I think that, unfortunately, that horse has probably already left the barn.
That's Neil Borofsky. He's the former watchdog of the bank bailout program. He says after 5 years, the government is running out of time to bring these cases. And that leaves a baffling paradox, according to Frank Partnoy.
We'll end up with this epic financial crisis where at least Senate investigators suggested that crimes were committed and yet no one goes to jail.
Carl Levin, the senator whose investigation triggered the case against Goldman, attributed the outcome to either weak laws or weak enforcement. It seems that the worst economic meltdown since the Great Depression is just nobody's fault. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
That's what you call a perfect segue to the next 4.5 minutes of this radio show, our weekly wrap of Wall Street and beyond. For that, we've got Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine and Felix Salmon from Reuters in our studios in New York. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
All right, so Felix, what do you think? Is there nothing to see here? Let's move on. Is that what we get out of this ruling on Goldman?
This was a relatively narrow case at the best of times. You know, they might conceivably have found enough evidence to bring criminal charges on one mortgage-backed security deal, which was put together by one bank. But you can't blame the entire financial crisis on one mortgage-backed security deal from one bank. I think that what we've discovered here is that criminal charges are incredibly hard to bring, and that you can't just say, oh, well, we've managed to find some wrongdoing at one bank, therefore it was all Goldman's fault.
All right. I'm going to get back to that point. But Lee, what do you think? Is Wall Street, you know, getting away with it here or what?
I mean, there's certainly been other opportunities that I think have been greater misses than Goldman this week. I mean, you know, if you think about it, no regulators have been able to. We know this. No one has gone to jail for this. Whether that's Bear Stearns a couple of years ago, two traders, Lehman, MF Global. I think you know, Countrywide. You know, the only person in jail is Bernie Madoff. I mean, but you know, there's. I think that, you know, there was probably a stronger case to be made with the case of Lehman Brothers, or certainly with MF Global. You know, it does seem that being greedy is not criminal. And that was what a lot of this is about.
Right.
So it's very hard to prove that the law was broken, although there was definitely the congressional report did say that, you know, traders were calling these securities really bad, flying pigs and all this stuff. And
worse words than that.
Yes,
which
exactly.
Which we can't say on this radio show.
Radio.
Yeah.
Yes.
Felix, let me go back to you for a second. In the totality of this thing, we now look back. The American public looks back. And for all that they can tell, Wall Street did its thing, and we're done now. Right?
Right. And you know, it's possible for a lot of money to be lost and a lot of chaos to be caused by entirely legal actions. I'm not convinced that everything that happened in the run-up to the crisis was entirely legal, but I think Lee makes a good point. If you look at Countrywide, for instance, which is now a part of Bank of America,
the
I think the wrongdoing there...
Yeah.
Was much greater than the mortgage-backed deals which were going on at Goldman.
And so, Lee, just to put the nail in this coffin, we should just move on, right? Nobody's going to go to jail, and let's regroup and proceed.
I mean, I don't think that's right, and I don't think the public should just move on. I mean, I think ideally there would be more effort made to find the wrongdoing that Felix mentioned, the stuff that really was you know, illegal or, mm-hmm. you know, broke the regulations, because it's out there. I mean, and clearly the public is hungering for it. There is definitely, there's been a lack of enough and hard enough prosecution. I really do. Yeah.
But the other thing is there's a huge amount of blame to go around, and it's really hard to pin it all on, like, one criminal act.
Right.
We all were part of that big bubble.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, there's a whole look in the mirror thing here that people ought to do, right, Felix?
The borrowers were part of it. The underwriters were part of it. The investors were part of it. The ratings agencies were part of it. The politicians were part of it. You know, the regulators themselves were part of it. And that's maybe one of the reasons they're not being too zealous about bringing charges, because they know that a lot of the fault is on themselves.
But on the other hand, some of this is exactly what happened in the late 90s with the analyst scandal, you know, touting things that you knew were bad, and people really paid for it, and nobody's paying right now. So things are a little different.
Yeah, and I wanted to move on, but I can't, because what's going to happen now is the people are going to read the headlines in the papers, and they're going to be left with the impression that nobody's paying for this except the American consumer. Felix?
Or Lee, take your pick.
You guys discuss amongst yourselves.
I think that's absolutely right, Kai. I think that's absolutely right. And the other thing to think about is what's happening now that we're going to learn about a couple months or a couple years from now. I mean, if there's this message that this is all going to get, no one's going to pay, whether they should or shouldn't can be debated forever, but no one is going to. So if that's the case, you know, what else is being done? We've learned that clearly lots and lots of big risks are still being taken. That's what we learned from the J.P. Morgan trade.
Right.
What else is happening out there that will only surface in the future?
There are big monetary fines, remember. Being paid. These banks are paying billions of dollars in fines for wrongdoing.
But
it's not individuals going to jail, and that's the thing which has the deterrent effect.
Right. All right. We got to go. But very quickly, $550 million to Goldman Sachs, Felix, is like nothing, right?
Exactly.
All right. We got to go. Felix Hammond from Reuters, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Have yourselves a good weekend, guys.
Thanks, Guy.
All right. We'll see you. Another day, another flat close on Wall Street. We will have the details, such as they were, when we do the numbers. Random fact of the day for this Friday. It cost more for London to put on the Olympics that wrap up this weekend, about $15 billion, than it did for NASA to send that rover up to Mars this past weekend, around $2.5 billion for that. But relative costs aside, the games have gone pretty well for the Brits, at least as seen from the outside. From London, Christopher Worth has the view from the inside.
Perhaps the most quintessentially British verdict on these Olympics came from London's Mayor Boris Johnson speaking to a Fox News reporter.
It's all going horribly right. I mean, you know, so far, touch wood, without being complacent, we do think we're having a very good game so far.
But horribly right belies a certain glumness here that it could have gone horribly awry, with all the dire predictions of traffic jams, driving rain, and inadequate security. The British collectively held their breath before the game started. Oliver Hun, a bicycle courier in London, was among them.
We're quite pessimistic as a country, I think.
Before the opening ceremonies, the Guardian newspaper ran a gloomy front-page preview of the games under the headline, What Could Go Wrong? Joe Twyman is in charge of social research at the British polling firm YouGov. He says, in a way, the British almost see disaster as an opportunity to show off their trademark ability to muddle through.
We don't like to get our hopes up.
He says the country's chronic pessimism has pervaded everything from the Queen's recent jubilee to the royal wedding to, well, he's not sure how far back it goes.
I have heard it said that people didn't expect to win the Battle of Hastings in 1066. I mean,
That'd be the battle between English King Harold and William the Conqueror, which Harold did lose. Since then, Twyman says, expecting the worst is kind of baked into British genetics.
We don't want to go into things thinking we're going to be the best in case we're not. And so I guess what you could say is that we don't really like disappointment.
But with the games almost over and no disasters yet, the mood here has brightened a bit. The host nation has hauled in more than 50 medals, almost half them gold. I found Londoner Patrick Jones celebrating outside a pub.
You know, we've probably put on the best Olympic Games in the world, and I think Britain should be proud of that.
In a horribly cheerful London, I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
The ongoing drought helped set more records today, the kind, sadly, that you don't want to be setting. Corn prices hit an all-time high this morning. The Department of Agriculture said it figures we could have the worst corn harvest we've had in 17 years. And since there's not a whole lot of water falling from the sky, much of the farm belt in this country is looking underground to local aquifers. But here's the thing about that. A new study in the journal Nature says 20% of the world's aquifers are being overexploited. That is, the water level is going down, in part because water is not priced like other scarce commodities. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, today transplanted to Lubbock, Texas, Scott Tong is on it.
In the hot, dry Texas panhandle, they talk rain. They pray for it. They sing about it, kind of.
Raining in my heart.
Buddy Holly was born in Lubbock. He was the biggest thing that ever happened here. Well, him and irrigation. When farmers started to pump water from below in the 1940s and 50s, it changed everything. Cotton farmer Kirby Lewis.
This area, if it wasn't for the way the water's been utilized, these cities wouldn't be here.
But here, groundwater, like oil, is finite. Just go north to the town of Happy, Texas. Hardly anyone's left. Main Street stores boarded up decades ago. I did find wheat farmer Clyde Hancock. He's 86.
We got in a drought like we are now, and that's when we started to drill in the wells. They pumped them for 20, 30 years and kind of run out of water.
What did Main Street used to look like?
One time there was grocery stores and drug stores and had a doctor, cafes. Oh, in the 40s, 50s, back in there, it was a pretty thriving little town.
Dave Brower met me in Happy. He works for the agriculture department.
This, in some parts of the high southern plains, is what we can expect to happen if we do not use the water wisely over time.
Brower's job is to extend the life of the aquifer below, the Ogallala Aquifer. It's, as my kids would say, ginormous. It's America's largest underground water source. It runs under 8 states and feeds a lot of the breadbasket. If you think about your gas tank, the aquifer was on full for thousands of years. But in West Texas, it refills awfully slowly. So the needle's falling.
Where we've had irrigated agriculture, we're at least halfway. In other places, we're probably closer to E.
Academics estimate that in certain parts, there's 10, 20, maybe 50 years of water left. Until, well, to steal another line from local boy Buddy Holly. That'll be the day when I die away. To many, the problem is water for farmers is free, or at the very least, it's underpriced, so it's overused. Robert Glennon at the University of Arizona wrote the book Unquenchable.
We have mistakenly set up the system based on the assumption that water was in ample supply. We think in the United States of water as though it were the air.
It all goes back a century, Glennon says. The U.S. was going west, young man. And to encourage farming and ranching and mining, the states allowed unlimited water use for everyone.
When I think about our water supply, I think of a giant milkshake glass. And I think of each demand for water as a straw in the glass. What most states have permitted is a limitless number of straws in the same glass.
Today, 36 states are projecting water shortages next year. And for regulators, it's hard to limit use, especially in Texas, where groundwater is part of your private property. Again, Kirby Lewis, the cotton farmer.
It's not a crime to pump water that you own. Cutting people off from their private property and then some of the other things they're proposing, they're un-American.
To many farmers, the people warning about water running out are not prophets. They're Chicken Little. These farmers say the projections assume today's technology. And out here, it keeps advancing. Cotton farmer J.O. Dottie shows me his high-tech pivoting sprinkler. It's a giant arm with wheels. It sprays water in a big circle at plant height. That way, hardly any water is lost to evaporation.
Just vision a rainstorm coming through and putting a half inch on this whole farm. That's what I'm doing with that sprinkler system.
And the next innovation is already here, underground irrigation with zero water loss. Tomorrow's breakthrough? Well, some think energy might get cheap enough to move large amounts of water into the aquifer, say from the Mississippi River. The key is to buy as much time as possible through innovation or regulation or price on water. And maybe, just maybe, the land of cotton can stay that way for a few more generations. Maybe, baby. You'll be true. Baby, baby, I'll have you for me. In Lubbock, Texas, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Scott took some pictures of Happy Texas, which today isn't all that happy, while I was down there. They're online at marketplace.org. Well, you are the one that makes me glad. Coming up, you invest in a big-time sports franchise. Why?
People would not cash the checks. They would frame them.
That's what I'm saying. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, so the Dow Industrials eked out a gain of 42 points today, about a third of 1%, 13,207 at the bell. The NASDAQ edged 2 points higher, a fraction of 1%, 3,020 is the number you're looking for. The S&P 500 tacked on 3 points. 0.2%, ended things at 1405. The Dow wrapped up the week 0.9% higher. The NASDAQ grew by 1.8%. The S&P 500 topped 1% in the gain column. Shares of JCPenney put on almost 6% today after executives outlined a new turnaround plan. I probably should say another new turnaround plan. Investors drove shares of Facebook by 3.8% higher. Netflix CEO Reed Hastings became a big-time investor in the social networking site. He bought $1 million worth of its stock. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.66%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. First Lady Michelle Obama makes an appearance on The Tonight Show. After the Olympics wrap, things quiet down in London, unless you're at the airport. And on August 13th, 1997, that sweet little animated series South Park made its television debut. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. There are a couple of new reports out on tobacco use. Tobacco sales to minors hit an all-time low last year, which is good. The not-so-good report, though, came from the CDC, which said the number of African-American kids smoking cigars is double what it was a couple of years ago. Researchers say they're not exactly sure why that is, but Dan Gorenstein reports now from New Hampshire Public Radio. Their best guess is price.
Why are black kids puffing all these little cigars? Thomas Glynn at the American Cancer Society says corner store economics.
Small cigars cost as little as 7 cents each, and meaning $1.40 a pack compared to a pack of cigarettes in a place like, for instance, New York City, where you'll spend $10, $11, or even $12.
The CDC says use among this population climbed between 2009 and 2011. Glynn says that's no coincidence.
Federal excise tax went up $1 in 2009, but it did not include cigar and pipe tobacco.
What's odd is that over the past 2 years, little cigar use has not gone up among Asians, Latinos, or whites. The rapper Snoop Dogg is shilling Executive Branch cigars, the musician's own company. Danny McGoldrick with the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids says manufacturers have a long history of marketing to African Americans.
When you associate a product, even that most people know is not good for you, is unhealthy, but when you associate it with very popular icons, then you change the affect around that product.
University of Michigan economist Kenneth Warner says tobacco companies see little cigars as a way to grow their business.
Alternatives to cigarettes could well be the direction that the industry is going to move unless regulators decide they're going to treat products like small cigars like cigarettes.
Warner says big tobacco is holding its breath, hoping that doesn't happen. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
We mentioned corn prices and farmers earlier in the show today, but this drought we're having is an equal opportunity disaster. Anybody who makes their living from the land is getting hit by it. We did some culling around last month and found a cattle rancher named Ken Lennox in Rolla, Missouri. We had a good chat, he and I, so we've dialed him back up today. Mr. Lennox, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to hear from you.
So first things first, I guess, have you had any rain?
Since we talked last, we've had 0.6 inches, which brings us up to a grand total, I added it up, to 4.5 inches since March.
Which is clearly not enough.
Clearly not enough.
What's it doing actually on the ground? I mean, are you seeing the grasslands die and turn yellow and all that?
Yeah, that was the same as it was. It's just more prevalent. You see more timber dying out across the landscape. Nothing's green. The only thing the cattle have to eat is that's green is the leaves off the trees.
Can they eat that? I guess they can, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's men that are even cutting trees down, so they do have something green to eat.
Wow.
But our main problem is water right now. That's what's gotten a lot worse in the last 30 days is water for the cattle to drink. We're the ponds are going dry, one right after another. We're opening up old wells that haven't been used in 30 or 40 years.
At this point, you'll take what you can get, right?
That's right. Same way with hay. Take what we can get. I don't have enough hay if we have to start feeding in October and November. So we're in the market trying to buy hay right now.
Yeah. Have you started selling off any of your herd yet?
Not of the main breeding herd. I'll only sell the ones that have no calf in them. If we don't get rain in September, we're really in trouble. Now, I can make it through the rest of August into September, but my herd starts calving the 1st of September, and I want them to be in good shape to rebreed back.
Yeah, and if you got baby calves there, I mean, what are you going to do with them if you can't feed them?
That's where my living comes from, so I have to take care of them.
So this is going to sound like a completely ridiculous city slicker question to ask, but do you suppose the cows know something's going on?
Oh, their routine has changed greatly. They're walking a lot further between meals, you might say. If I have to fudge on feed, I want to do it while the weather's warm, not in the wintertime. So I've forced them to stay on pastures longer while it's warm, and they're eating leaves off of trees and dead grass, and I do not want to short them when the weather's cold.
So how much longer can you go on like this, Mr. Lennox?
Well, I can go through the year. That's all right, but in the 1950s, we had three of these years in a row. That's got me worried almost as much as just what's going on this year.
1950s, you must have been like what, 15, 20 years old?
Young teenager, yes. Yeah.
But you remember that?
Yes, I remember it very well.
Well, Mr. Lennox, good luck to you. We'll call you in a month or so, see how you're doing, all right?
Okay, and you have a good day too.
Diehard fans of one of the most well-known sports names on the planet had a chance to put their money where their mouths are today. England's 134-year-old Manchester United Soccer Club is now a publicly traded company. The IPO values Man U, as it's known, at something near $2.3 billion, which, not coincidentally, makes it the richest sports franchise in the history of sports franchises. But the team raised less money in the markets today than it had hoped. And our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, explains that's in part because sports is a hard sell on Wall Street.
Manchester United is looking to pay down its heavy debt, but half the $233 million raised will go to the Florida-based Glazer family, which bought control of the team in 2005. They also own the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. So what do investors get for their money? Here's what CEO David Gill told CNBC this morning.
You're buying into what is one of the world's most iconic brands playing in the fastest-growing sport in the world. And we can demonstrate across all our revenue streams great growth opportunities.
There's a chance Manchester United could make good on that promise, but don't quit your day job, so says sports business consultant Patrick Risch.
They certainly have done a fantastic job of marketing their brand internationally for years and years. So if anyone has a shot to generate a little something for their stockholders, it would be Man U.
But at the College of the Holy Cross in Massachusetts, sports business expert Victor Matheson is skeptical because the team's operating costs are also going up.
It's becoming ever more expensive to attract the talent you need to maintain Man U as a leading worldwide brand.
Matheson says the teams often make out better than their public investors, but it's apparent that many are fans who don't seem to care anyway. At the research firm IPO Financial, David Menlo recalls the strange case of the stock dividends paid by the Boston Celtics years ago.
People would not cash the checks. They would frame them.
Those who held onto shares of the Cleveland Indians during the decade that team traded publicly realized 50% gains, provided they bothered to cash them in, that is. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out, another visit to our Urban Financial Dictionary. We've been collecting your slang terms for money this week. Here's what it sounds like when the pros do it.
Cream, C-R-E-A-M by Wu-Tang.
Cream, get the money.
It's all about Benjamins. By then, Puff Daddy.
Cash is Gouda. That's courtesy of the rapper E-40.
Cash is Gouda? I don't know. I always thought it was a cheese. Whatever. All right, we still want yours, music or no. Hit us up on our Facebook page or at Twitter. We're at Marketplace, APM. And that is Marketplace from APM on this Friday. Today, the Dow eked out a gain of 42 points, about a third percent. The NASDAQ edged higher 2 points, a fraction of 1%. The S&P 500 tacked on 3 points, 0.2%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. J.J. Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, we're talking tithing.
Mormons or Latter-day Saints are often known for their practice of provident living, having money set aside, having food set aside, having clothing and gasoline or whatever you might need for a rainy day.
Mormons and their money. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We're back on Monday. But in the meanwhile, have yourselves a great weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.